This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should be watching these movies.
But we're here to see if they're right.
Join us as we take a cinematic journey through independent and classic film.
So dim the lights.
And get ready for the show.
This is Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. Welcome to the podcast that wears the big suit. This is the Movie Dude Eric, and along with me are...
This is Kent, and I've got a tape I want to play.
This is Chris, and I didn't pick anything here, so yeah, it's just Chris.
In this episode, we're discussing Stop Making Sense, starring Bernie Worrell, Alex Weir, Stephen Scales, Lynn Mabria, Edna Holt, Tina Weymouth, Jerry Harrison, Chris Franz, and David Byrne, also known as The Talking Heads, directed by Jonathan Demme. So gentlemen, let's start off with the first question that we should be asking ourselves when it comes to a rockumentary. Have you ever heard of the Talking Heads before this?
I'm a child of the 80s. Yes. So. Except I am not that... We weren't very super exposed. So it's like we knew Once in a Lifetime and... Oh, what's the other one? Burning Down the House is the two major ones that really got a lot of airplay. Not too deep into the other songs, though.
So you're just familiar with the singles? You didn't, like, buy an album or have a friend who listened to the album?
I didn't. Not really. My friends were metalheads, mostly, by the time I got into buying albums, so...
Well, what about you, Chris? What is your familiarity with the Talking Heads, if any at all?
Very briefly. Some of the songs I'm pretty sure I've heard before, but probably just in passing on the radio. The film was released and I was born, so yeah, there you go.
Fair enough.
I've not heard much of their stuff. So.
All right, I'm going to take a time machine back to 1992. I made a friend... in San Angelo, Texas. This is a city that is in West Texas. And I would spend weekends over at his house, or he'd spend weekends over at my house. And at his house, he had this music collection that was wild all over the place, from rock to rap to heavy metal to country, everything. But he had one song that he would play over and over and over again on his CD player, to the point where I could probably sing the song verbatim, that he's listened to this song so often. And that song is Psycho Killer. I had never heard of the Talking Heads before, and I never heard another song from the Talking Heads until I was in high school. But I heard Psycho Killer so often that I could sing it verbatim for the longest time. And then when I got into into high school and I started listening to, you know, that mixed type of radio station that had the 70s, 80s, and 90s music, stuff like that. And then I would hear, like, Burning Down the House and their other songs. But the thing was, is I didn't realize that was the Talking Heads until they actually announced it. And it was like, oh, so they had other songs besides Psycho Killer.
Yeah.
And so that was my familiarity with Talking Heads going, you know, from that particular point. Now, this documentary, this rockumentary, is also directed by the late, great Jonathan Demme. Now, Kent, you remember our conversation on another one of his little tiny films called Silence of the Lambs.
Yes, Kiddies.
Chris, you weren't there for this, so I have to ask, what is your familiarity, what's your opinion of Jonathan Demme as a director? How many of his films have you seen, if any?
Well, I'd have to look it up. I mean, I've seen Silence of the Lambs, obviously, but...
I would have had to question your critic credits if you hadn't seen Silence of the Lambs.
I'm pulling up his stuff now. Let me see. Okay.
I'm biting my tongue at this particular point that you have to actually pull up IMDb to see what movies he's
done. Yeah, just Silence of the Lambs. That's it.
Well, you've never seen Philadelphia or Beloved or Married to the Mob or Something Wild or Rachel Getting Married. I mean, the dude just made so many insanely good movies. Actually, can't we kind of talked about Jonathan Demme before when we did Manchurian Candidate. Although, I don't know if you saw that movie. I can't remember.
Manchurian?
The Denzel Washington one, though.
Oh, the later one. Yeah. No, just the original.
All right, so you're not familiar with that one. But, all right. So, needless to say, I guess I've proven that I'm actually quite a huge fan of Jonathan Demme as a director. I guess, in case anyone didn't listen to that Silence of the Lambs episode, now you know. But what other movies besides Silence of the Lambs did you see up to this movie? What other films are you familiar with?
Of his, I am not 100% on that. Because Philadelphia is one of those that I always meant to watch and never got around.
Okay, you know we're doing it next year then, right? Because
I'm pretty sure we gotta if or sooner.
I feel like
fit it
like
in the schedule.
The fact that neither one of you have seen some of his amazing work is just driving me crazy. If I had any hair on my head, it would be ripped out right now, because in my opinion, Jonathan Demme is one of the most skillful and most eye-drawing directors of all time. This is a director who's capable, who understands the subjectivity of cinema and understands just how to draw an audience's attention to where exactly it is that he wants you to pay attention. And that's actually something that really impresses me about this particular movie. Stop Making Sense is, for all intents and purposes, your standard rockumentary. You know, it's a rock band. It's a concert. We're going to be watching them perform. We're going to be seeing their onstage antics, things that you would normally find with this type of rockumentary. Yet, you could argue that there's something very unique about what this movie does, or at least that's what I'm going to do, because I have to say that after I saw this movie, I was taken aback. I had seen other documentaries that Demme had done. He had done the Neil Young, the Neil Young Heart of Gold rockumentary. I think he did a couple others that I'm flaking that I can't remember off the top of my head, but he's done, you know, rockumentaries before, or he'd done them after this. This was his first rockumentary. But, yeah, there's something very interesting about what this movie does differently than other rockumentaries. Now, Kent, you know, this is not our first rockumentary, right? We've done Gimme Shelter about the Rolling Stones. And I guess you could say the mockumentary, This is Spinal Tap, is one of our first movies. So, what other have you seen any other rockumentaries since we?
Oh, since or during or before? Nothing is jumping to mind right now.
Okay.
But the real question here is it a documentary or is it just the concert film? Yeah, because we don't see any kind of behind the scenes. We don't see any kind of backstage. We don't see any talking about how the album or any of the songs were made. It's just song, 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 song. And you figure in a documentary style, they do some weird cut and have somebody talk about, oh yeah, I got this idea and somebody just said this, and oh, we gotta write that down as lyrics. And that's not what happens here. It's just straight concert.
Well, that's true, but even for a concert film, there are elements that I feel that are standard for the genre, which is most notably audience participation. Every concert film, every film that is, even with the likes of like the Tommy or even with like stage performances like the Rent stage performance or Newsies, it goes back to the audience. It wants to kind of check in on the audience. It wants to see how the audience is responding to what's happening on stage. And what I find very fascinating right off the bat, and this was something that I kind of saw in the first time I saw it, and then more notably on the second, is the fact that the audience, for the most part, is almost muted out until the very end of the movie. You see the audience is there, but it's almost like Demi is trying his hardest to keep them out of the frame. He's, you know, you'll see silhouettes, but you won't actually see audience members until the very end, right?
It's, I think, because we are the audience. We are the camera. But we're also kind of an omnipotent audience, where we're moving between angles instead of being statically in one spot. Most of the time, we're not even in the audience. So most of the time, we're on stage. So,
but
it's,
what do you think about the times that, specifically, David Byrne will break the fourth wall? He'll look straight into the camera.
Oh, that's fine. It's good. He's crazy. He's not making sense. But he is making sense. But...
Oh, we'll be talking about David Byrne in just a minute.
He's playing to the audience of us. So,
but what about you, Chris? What are you taking away from the lack of audience response and kind of how the film presents itself between us and the band?
I mean, I guess I didn't really notice much because I felt like. Like as Ken said, that we are the audience. You know, I felt like, I don't know, I didn't really notice that the audience was muted until the end until you brought it up. Like, it didn't really click until you said that. And then it was like, oh yeah, I guess so. But,
All right, so let's talk about what we're seeing from the band. I have to admit, there was, the way that this show is choreographed and the way it's staged and the way that the production of the show itself is very wild and very vibrant, or at least that's kind of the feeling I'm getting. I mean, right from the beginning, when David Byrne comes out with his, you know, his acoustic guitar and his boombox,
yep,
and starts us off with Psycho Killer right off the bat in an acoustic version of Psycho Killer at that. In fact, I will say that almost every one of the songs that we get from this documentary sounds nothing at all like this, like the produced one, like the one that you would hear on the yeah, tape or the 8-track or the CD
radio.
Yeah, this is a re-envisioned version of every song that's designed specifically for a stage. It's like you will never get this type of experience outside of being at the show, right? I mean, you've heard Burning Down the House. Did the version that you hear in the movie sound anything at all like the one that you would hear on the radio? So what do you think it is that makes it different between the stage version and the radio version? And Chris, feel free to jump in on this one if you think you...
I want to say it's a certain je ne sais quoi, but no, there's something. I feel like it feels the radio version just feels what we'd call today overproduced.
But is it though? I mean, okay, so we also have to keep in mind this is a film that was made in 1984 about a contemporary band of that time. You know, this was, but at the same time, though, the Talking Heads are not what we would call an iconic. This is not like Aerosmith or Black Sabbath. You know, this doesn't have, the Talking Heads will never be on that level of a fan base. This was kind of indie, weird 80s synth and kind of oddity, right? I mean, this is, like, I would feel like you could say the same thing about Talking Heads that you could say about maybe, like, Devo, maybe? Or, you know, or other music of the 80s that feels specifically of the 80s. You know what I'm saying? But one thing that I found very fascinating about the way that the music is constructed for the stage is how much of the instruments that we have on in the show that are, you know, actual, like, instruments, and what are synth instruments, or, you know, that they have an electronic component to the, you know, to the production of the music. Like, yeah, we have keyboards, but we'll also have bongos, and we'll have tribal drums, and we'll have acoustic guitars, and we'll, like, at one particular point, in what I would consider to be almost, you know, just almost blasphemy, is that you'll have a synth bass right alongside an actual bass. Like, they are breaking rules, you know, of music. You know, just that kind of insanity, this kind of, like, I would almost want to call it Looney Tunes of rock. You know, like I would not be surprised if, like, David Byrne had painted a, you know, had painted a train tunnel, and an actual train came out of it, you know, lyrically speaking. I mean, this is wild. This is craziness, right? I mean, did any of this feel like, I guess the best way to say it is, does any of this feel organized? Gentlemen, did I completely blow your minds with that?
Oh, organized
meaning what?
Organized chaos.
But seriously though, I mean, look at the arrangement of instruments that we have in the show. I mean, we start off with an acoustic guitar, then we go to electric guitar, bass, and then after that we go to bongos and bass with drums. We have, wind instruments. We have, I'm losing track of all the instruments. I feel like I should have written down every instrument that was used. We have synth basses. We have actual basses. We have, you know, you know, electric guitars right alongside acoustic guitars. We have tribal drums. We have, you know, in fact, I wouldn't be surprised if someone was, like, using one of those jugs to blow.
At some point, yeah.
but seriously, though, I mean, did any of you notice the variety of instruments that were used in any particular song? Considering, like, let's say, like, Burning Down the House, which uses, what, electric guitar, acoustic guitar, synth bass. I believe for this particular version, I think they were using the tribal drums for Burning Down the House.
Which they did, yeah.
Yeah, I mean...
I was going to say, but there's no woodwinds or brass, so...
I know that brass was used in later Talking Heads albums, but I don't, for this one particularly, I don't think that they did. I don't think that they were using them for this.
This show doesn't have any. Yeah.
But, I mean, I think there was even xylophone, wasn't there? I think, wasn't there a xylophone at some point?
I think at one point, I thought I saw one. Not you bring it up, but...
I mean... Especially, you know, the thing is that when it comes to music, I really love awesome drum lines, beats. I think that your percussion in a rock, especially when it comes to rock, can make the difference between a bland song with a song with punch, especially with the kind of wild acoustics that you would get for Talking Heads. Between all the different songs, there is some very difficult and very crazy rhythms that are being used here, right?
It's all in the hands of the songwriter.
which for the most part comes down to David Byrne and Tina Weymouth. From what it seems, what it sounds like, they're the two main songwriters for Talking Heads. And on top of that, I guess y'all noticed in the documentary that there's one song that David is not anywhere a part of, and the rest of the band, which goes by kind of a nickname called the Tom Tom Club, but you know, they get their own song, and their own song sounds completely different from the other songs that David Byrne is doing, right?
Is that the one where it ends with him going, and now we're going back to being Talking Heads?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they start off with "This is the Tom Tom Club." They do their song, and then they go back to being Talking Heads, because then David comes back, and he comes back in the crazy coat or the crazy
coat,
suit.
The suit, yeah.
But what did you think about the differences between, I guess, the Talking Heads and Tom Tom Club? And if you feel that there's absolutely no difference, then please feel free to...
I didn't really get a difference, so...
I'd have to watch it again,
yeah.
Honestly.
Hey, y'all didn't see it twice? What?
One of my problems was I'd be listening to it, and I'd get sucked into the music that I don't notice what else is going on because I'm listening to the music.
So do you think that the music is so overwhelming that you stop paying attention to the stuff that's happening, or that it kind of that the music is just that dominant over the film?
Sometimes yes, which could be a good thing and a bad thing.
Well, were there any songs that you felt hurt the show, that it didn't feel like it worked for the show?
It seemed like everything flowed well, one to the other. So there's nothing I could sit back and say, what's that doing there? It doesn't really work, but it all works.
So you find yourself happy with how one song would end and how the next song would take over, that it felt like it was a natural transition between songs, that it didn't lose any vibes between any of the songs?
Sorry, when he started saying, "You may find yourself," and I'm like, "You may find yourself transitioning between songs and enjoying it." This is not the song I just listened to. This is not my "Late in the Days." No. See, that's the influence. I could start making jokes about the songs in this film, talking about the film, and enjoying the film and the music. So, but to answer your question, sort of, yes, I guess. So.
No problem. But what about you, Chris? Did you find yourself being overwhelmed by the music, or did the music not work? Where do you stand in regards to the film and how it presents the music?
I mean, I was fine with it. I mean, I was pretty much into it. I just, maybe it's just because I watched it once, and maybe my opinion will change when I see it again or whatever. Kind of think it should have ended after "Take Me to the River."
Honestly, I think that that's the end of the show. I think that Cross-Eyed and Painless was more kind of an encore. Which is, I think, okay. The reason why we got the audience response, because that's what, at the end of a concert, that's what will happen, is that the audience will build up and build up and build up, and they'll ask for one more, or it'll be encouraged that the artist will come back out.
Right.
I think that's the reason why they had it there. It was just a means to explain, okay, this is the encore that's about to come up. Because it's not, because audiences don't actually scream out encore. You know?
Yeah.
That's not something that actually happens. And I get the sense that Demi wanted to give the understanding of how the audience, because he doesn't give the audience an opportunity to show their love of the show throughout the rest of the show. So he wanted to have it in this one moment. This is the moment you're going to see the audience really excited. You're going to see them dancing. You're going to see them excited. You're going to see them happy. And he gives it to you in this one burst. And then, of course, they'll go into the last song, which will lead us straight into credits. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where I saw with in regards. But yeah, Take Me to the River is a great ender. Now, I should also say that as much as I will consider myself an okay fan with the Talking Heads, I'm a diehard for Al Green. I love me some Al Green. And I cannot tell you which version I like better. Because Al Green has this kind of... He makes Take Me to the River sound smooth and sexy because that's what Al Green does.
Al Green does, yeah.
You know, he could probably sing the Beans Magical Fruit song and make you actually like, oh yeah.
Yeah,
I'm just saying that's what he does. But I also love how David Byrne takes that song and he understands the rhythms of the song and being able to turn that song into a Talking Head song. He makes it natural for the Talking Heads, which is what I think a cover should do. A cover shouldn't be a remake of that song. It needs to be that song as interpreted by this band. You know, we kind of had that happen earlier this week when a certain band was cajoled into covering a certain Toto song. I don't know if you heard that or not.
I did not hear this
Weezer one.
Yes.
Okay.
You didn't hear about Weezer being cajoled into covering Africa?
No.
Yeah, they had a Twitter follower who named themselves Weezer Covers Toto's Africa, and like got Twitter all but, you know, just burning for them to do this cover of Africa, to the point where Weezer responded by doing Rosanna at first as kind of a troll thing, and then after a couple of weeks they finally did Africa. But yeah, give it a shot, listen to it, and kind of see what I'm talking about in regards to that. But one thing that I gotta say that, you know, I guess the next question I would have is, considering your limited knowledge of the Talking Heads, would this movie actually encourage you to go out and listen to more Talking Heads or to check out any of their other concert films? Because they actually have, I think, two more out there. None directed by Jonathan Demme, mind you. But
yeah. They have two full films or...
Well, they're concert films. Not to mention a movie that I desperately want to talk about that's killing me that I can't talk about right now.
True Stories, yeah.
We will talk about True Stories at some point. To say that I love True Stories is being extremely polite. It's, yeah, that you will understand when you see True Stories what I'm talking about. But do you find yourself... like more interested in getting to know more about the Talking Heads after watching this movie?
Oh. The problem is I'm getting to the age where it's like, there's so much, I know there's so much out there I need to absorb, and there's too much out there, and so it's not a priority over about 10,000 other things.
But if you happen to find yourself, like, on a car trip, and you happen to have a copy of Talking Heads albums, would you plug it in, or would you go to something else?
I have all, somehow... the entire Talking Heads discography, somehow appeared in MP3 format on a device that I could listen to. Yeah, I might go ahead and listen to that. So,
yeah.
But it's a difference between what you're asking is know more about the band versus listening to the band, because apparently David Byrne is an interesting character all in himself.
Okay, I don't expect anyone to obsess over things that I do, because no one needs that kind of insanity in their lives, and I strongly discourage people from following my particular passions, because I drive people crazy all the time with my obsessions. But what I mean is, you know, would you, if you happen to find yourself in an environment where this stuff is is available to you, would you be more interested in checking this stuff out? Like, if it was a lazy Saturday and you found, oh, there's a Talking Heads album, or, oh, there's a Talking Heads concert film, and you had nothing better to do, would you do it, or would you step away from it?
I mean, watch another one?
Yeah. And Chris, feel free to bring your opinion, too.
I would. Yeah, why not?
You know, it may be a difference between would I watch it again or would I put it on in the background while something else is happening.
So it sounds to me like you wouldn't go to a Talking Heads concert or watch a Talking Heads concert film, but you would have the music playing. That the music is something that you
is it?
Connect to, but as to the, you know, watching the band or you know, more interest in the band itself, not really.
Not as much, unless we had some true doc, kind of, as I would say, a true documentary instead of a concert film where it's like, and this was the process where this happened, and this is this wacky story from that we called a video.
Oh, you want the behind the music.
I kind of want a behind the music, but with music, so...
I'm pretty sure you can find that on YouTube somewhere. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that there's been a few
people... An episode, yeah.
...obsessed over Talking Heads. But, all right, so I guess for me, I want to get into the actual visual aspects of the film, because as much as this is a Talking Heads concert, this is a Jonathan Demme movie. And if anything, we know Jonathan Demme as a director who... Again, as I've mentioned before, loves to draw the eye to things. And I guess you could... do you feel... Or do you kind of see what Jonathan Demme sees in Talking Heads? Why he would go out of his way to make a concert film for this... For this band? Because he pursued them. He really wanted to make this concert film about them. This wasn't something where they paid him to do this. Unlike, say, Jay-Z when he got Ron Howard to do his movie and stuff like that, right? He, you know, this was a passion project for Jonathan Demme. But do you kind of see the elements of the Talking Heads that would draw a director to, you know, to want to make a movie of their concert?
Well, they were big enough during the early 80s that, yeah, I can see that.
But what do you think it was that Demme saw in the concert itself? You kind of look at the way that he... The visual elements that he paid attention to on the scene. What do you think was that he found himself drawn to?
They have like a unique stage presence, I think, because it's not... They're not just, like, singing. They're not just standing there singing. They're doing shit the whole time. And, like, they're fucking running around. Like, I do not see how Byrne has that much fucking energy, man. I know it's filmed over 3 nights, but goddamn.
Okay, I got
like, just watching him made me tired. Like,
I was sweaty. I make jokes that he makes jazzercise instructors tired watching him. Oh, but man. Here's something that that is probably going to blow your mind, or it blew my mind. Did you know that David Byrne is an avid teetotaler? He doesn't drink, he doesn't smoke, he doesn't use drugs. Okay. He is completely sober. Think about that, watching him on that stage and knowing that he wrote the majority of the lyrics for these songs. I would go as far as to say is that the Talking Heads, when it comes to lyrics, is as wild as maybe the Beatles. And I'm talking about the LSD period of the Beatles, too. Like, take Once in a Lifetime and take Yellow Submarine or Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Tell me that one is trippier than the other. Come on.
Well,
people don't need that shit to be creative, yeah. I guess, you know?
It was the 80s, after all.
It was the 80s.
Well, I mean, there is a lyric in... Is there a lyric in there about our president's insane and da-da-da? And it's like, wow, the thing old is new again.
I want to say
I thought that too.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he wasn't a fan of Reagan, but oh my god.
Well, I don't think there was many artists that were fans of Reagan at that particular point.
No. Not too many. So, or at least that was the thing in music, was to be not for Reagan. So, but especially in Europe. So,
I will say on my end, when it comes to the Talking Heads, and specifically of David Byrne, David Byrne, in my opinion, is the unfiltered id of the 80s. He is like, or I shouldn't say he's the unfiltered id of the 80s. He's like the 70s and the 80s, it just kind of melded into one, and somehow David Byrne tapped into both generations, to both decades, and found this way of making wild, crazy music that felt contemporary for the 80s. And especially when you're watching the film and watching how he presents these songs, the way that he has the backdrops that he does, the way that he uses those screens in the background, the way that, you know, like how the words, you know, when the words kind of just, you know, throw themselves on there, like there's no association. Like all these words are so random. They make no sense together until they do make sense. And that's what's wild about how Byrne stages this stuff. The costuming, the way that everyone changes costumes from time to time. I mean, and it could be something as just like a shirt being changed or a hair being slicked back. And understand that this was taken from like three or four different concerts, so you also have to kind of keep that in mind, that you know, with those types of changes. But other times you could tell that it was a change that was made kind of on the spot too. Like, specifically Byrne, you know, he goes from, you know, the blue jeans and the button-up shirt to the, you know, we talked about the big suit, and then at one point he puts on this red, almost MAGA hat. You know, it's like, he's just like, and from what I understand, the hat came from the audience, he just decided to incorporate it. Like, that stuff that he does with, you know, with his shows, it feels unstaged. It feels like you mentioned before, kind of this organized chaos. You know that it's chaotic, but at the same time, there's order to it, right?
What I'm curious about with some of that, what's going on stage, how much is Byrne, and how much is Dem?
I think that's the biggest question when it comes to the Talking Heads. But at the same time, though, it's also very interesting that David Byrne does his most to try to keep from being in the spotlight. You know, the problem is that you could tell that he is such a force for the band that he, you know, again, they kind of have to rename themselves if he's not on stage with them, which is something I think is very interesting about how the documentary puts that. But at the same time, though, you know, like even with the credits, he puts himself dead last with no catchy, you know, like and featuring or and starring David Byrne. No, it's like he tries his hardest to minimize his stardom in the band and in the fact that he's kind of such a strong force for the band itself, right?
Which oddly intensifies his position because he is last without drawing attention, people notice that.
Well, I think that, you know, if he does, I feel like it's one of those things where he probably would have put himself in the middle, but the thing is that he also, I think that even the band has to recognize the fact people come for him as well. And so he can't just entirely fade into the background. You know, you could tell that he's the one who comes up with most of these songs. You could tell that he's the head of this you know, monstrosity. I'll call it a monstrosity because this thing just feels so big for such an obscure kind of, you know, indie band. You know, it feels bigger than it is, doesn't it? or am I kind of making more out of this than possible? I don't know.
Oh, I don't know if we'd call him indie, but...
Well, let's be honest here. Do they follow any trends of pop music? Do they do anything that you would say that you would consider to be mainstream? I would say that their success comes from the fact that, not that they chase success, but that people just realize how awesome their music is, or that there's something about their music that speaks out.
Or was just a little bit different than everything else going on at the time.
Well, that's definitely so.
Yeah.
But seriously, though, I mean, is there any aspect of their music that feels contemporary to even of the stuff of its time, much less today?
So it's time, kind of the use of the synth.
But did they use the synth in the other ways?
They mixed it with other things, which makes them unique. They weren't pure synth.
The synth was like in the background, right, though, or like in the 80s, it was more in the foreground, like the main attraction kind of thing.
Right.
This is more just like to blend in with everything else they had going on.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Like, whenever you talk about 80s synth, I'll be honest here, the first thing I think about is Hall & Oates.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's the kind of synth that I'm thinking. I would say the closest that you would get to being like... in the same family as what Talking Heads is doing is, again, Devo. And I don't have to tell you just how obscure Devo is.
Well, if a problem comes along with it. So, thing is, I think more people know Weird Al's interpretation of Devo than Devo now. But even though people kind of know Devo. I mean, if you arrived then, you know Devo. And some people now who are just studying 80s music are like, who are these guys? Whoa.
Talking Heads have more than one number one hit. Devo only has that one hit. They're a one-hit wonder, for all intents and purposes. And again, I'm not going to say that Devo doesn't have a hardcore fan base, but it's a small hardcore fan base. Talking Heads is slightly bigger, but it's still, especially if you look at it from the 80s perspective. You know, they do not pack stadiums. They do not pack. They're not gonna sell out Madison Square Garden, right? You know, they're not anywhere close to Michael Jackson, to kind of give you a comparison.
But they might sell out a small club here and there on a tour.
That's true, and that's what a small but dedicated fan base will do for a band, right? And David Byrne is still doing music. I mean, you know, in fact, he had an album that came out just this year. It's a solo album, and I think it's like his fifth or sixth. But yeah, David Byrne is still making music. If I'm not correct, he actually had a joke appearance on Stephen Colbert's show. I want to say either this year or last year. So he's still out there, but.
He, I believe, is doing some composing.
Well, no, he had an album that came out this year, so he is still doing music.
I think some of the other band members have been doing stuff for other things too. Yeah. So
I don't know if Talking Heads are still together, but at the same time, though, how many bands are? I mean, you'll hear about a band here and there that'll stick around for, you know, decades, but. I don't know. I don't even think that Talking Heads probably could keep it together for long. Otherwise, it just feels stale. You know, that's. I think that's one of the elements of Talking Heads that is so that I find very exciting about them is the fact that, you know, it feels like improv. Very, you know, but at the same time, it's like, you know, if you look at it, you could probably tell where they, you know, where they've constructed this. But there's something jazzish. Improvisational about it, right? Like the lyrics all are over the place. Like they really do not make sense, like put together. I think Once in a Lifetime is the closest to like a a narrative that you're gonna get from a Talking Heads song, right?
It's was going to say burning down the house, but that's more an emotion of burning. No.
No, take all the lyrics of burning down the house. Does that make sense?
Weird. Yeah.
Extreme of consciousness.
Right. I used to sing along to that, too, on the radio sometimes. And then get the lyrics wrong. But
My girlfriend did the entire concert. You know, she sang every song in that concert. I'm not kidding. I have to admit, she was as much fun to watch as the movie. That's just saying how awesome my girlfriend is. And if she's listening, you're awesome. Yes.
Oh, hi.
All right. But, all right, so I guess I've splooged all over this movie as much as I can. Is there anything about the movie that you thought about or that you wanted to talk about?
Oh, interesting way they shot it on three different nights from multiple angles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and of course, trying to get the continuity right, which I think there's a few editing bugs with the lip syncing at times, mm-hmm. or maybe just there was my feed being weird when I was watching it, because sometimes it didn't seem like it linked up, but because they're probably using one night's audio track video that they combined three ways, so it's like,
that they're using different visuals with different audio at times, because there was some syncing issues. But at the same time, I don't think that was what Demi was going for. I don't think Demi was interested in continuity as much as he was trying to get the vibe. He wanted to give the concert experience on film. And in a way, I gotta say, and I know I'm tipping my hand way too much at this particular point, but who the fuck cares at this point?
love this film.
You know that a concert film works if you really wish you could have been there. That's when you know that it works, is if you watch the movie and you're going, damn, how awesome would it have been to have been in that room, to be seeing this live, to being a part of the dancing fools that were pretty much blacked out until the very end. How awesome would that have been? And yeah, as I'm watching it, I wish I could have been there. And I think that's what makes this this concert film was also the first concert film that I saw that was published on DVD. It was one of the first. And I always found that very fascinating that this concert film was that they were trying to sell this concert film as a reason to buy a DVD player back in 2000. And I can definitely see why, now that I've seen it in its entirety. Because especially if all you're familiar with is VHS, think about just pitch perfect sound and kind of getting that vibe, that feeling and that exertion that you're seeing. I mean, when you have the entire band running in place, like they're part of like a Nintendo track and field competition. when you see David just running around, like he was taking laps around the stage, like some coach just told him, just was lambasting him or something. The way that he would come back out with slick back hair, but at the same time, it only made him look cooler. Just that vibe, that excitement, very, very difficult to impersonate. You know what I mean? But is there anything else about the film that you wanted to talk about that we haven't gotten to?
Made Dancing with the Lamp seem kind of cool.
Yeah.
Oh, that was awesome. I also loved how he would he was tripping or falling over himself, but he did it to the beat. Like, mm-hmm. that's way crazy. He just makes it look natural, though. I mean, and who got an Andy Kaufman vibe off of the use of the boombox for Psycho Killer.
I wasn't going to say it was Koff. I didn't think about that.
Do y'all remember his Mighty Mouse gag? You know, where he would he would have the Mighty Mouse song playing on the record player, and then he would kind of lip sync to it.
Oh, well, except he's not really lip syncing here. He's just playing, and that's his background. So
it's basically a metronome that he's singing to on a boombox. You could have a metronome in any other way, but the fact that he uses a boombox to provide that, and again, it could be that he wasn't playing to it, that it was actually over a speaker, but the fact that he uses the boombox as a prop. And I guess you could say a lot about the props. We talked about the lamp, and there's other props that are used throughout the show that are just wild and insane. I mean, there's a beach ball at one point. I mean, yeah, it's kind of crazy.
You mean it doesn't make sense? Yeah.
Well, tell it to stop.
Yeah.
All right, gentlemen. I guess, is there really anything about the Geek Sheet? I mean, I mentioned quite a bit about David Byrne, and obviously I went over Jonathan Demme's, his filmography. But is there anything else?
Music from this gets used everywhere, just literally everywhere. So, if you just go to any of Byrne or Tina Weymouth's IMDb pages and look up some of their credits, and it will say soundtrack filmography credits. Like, they're everywhere. So it's almost everything on the planet. So.
All right, so is that all you can find?
For me, yes.
All right, I've got one more I got to talk about, because we actually have talked about this guy before, but Jordan Cronenweth, who is the cinematographer for this film. Now, I should make it very clear that Jonathan Demme, after this, would go to use Tak Fujimoto for most of his films, who, in my opinion, is one of the great cinematographers of all time. But Jordan Cronenweth has actually done a few movies that you probably know very well, including one that we've talked about here, which was Blade Runner.
Oh, okay.
Yes. But he was also the cinematographer for Altered States, which is a fucked up movie in its own right. I don't know if you've ever seen it. He actually also did the concert film for U2 Rattle and Hum. He's worked with Francis Ford Coppola on both Peggy Sue Got Married and Gardens of Stone. He's done a fair share of good cinematography in his own right. Although I'd probably say Tak Fujimoto is slightly better, but if we ever get around to The Sixth Sense or Signs, we can talk about Tak Fujimoto a little bit more in detail. All right, so, gentlemen, are we ready to call it?
Well, I might as well. Yeah.
Kent, Chris, do you agree with the critics on Stop Making Sense? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Chris?
I give it a pass. Because, you mentioned wanting to be in the room, like, when the concert was going. I mean, that's true, but, like, a lot of the time when something's good and it's kind of dated, it's usually like, oh, it was good for the time, or, you know, whatever that bullshit is, you know, whatever. This would be good now. I mean, it would be good today, still. It would still be, like, I'd want to see it today if I went to a concert or whatever, compared to, you know, however many years ago. I don't feel like doing math. And
over 30.
Over 30, yeah. And it's my age, that's sad. I want to watch the movie again. I do want to hear more talking heads, so that's done its job, you know. And it's a pass. I'm just gonna ramble, so pass.
Kent,
a weird conditional pass. If for some reason you don't like the music of the 80s, or some you have absolutely zero interest, then this movie isn't for you. But if you like, you know, music. And you want to see what a concert could be like that has a lot of energy from the band itself without, like, pyro or an obscene amount of special effects going on or 50 background dancers going, then this is what that kind of concert is. And yeah, this is the movie for that, I'd say. Now, it is lacking in the behind-the-scenes department, like Gimme Shelter had, or even, as we mentioned before, Spinal Tap, which is, you know, mockumentary, but it's missing those kind of elements. But for a straight beginning-to-end concert, this is it. This is a good example. So we're going to go with that and say pass.
I understand where you're coming from, Kent, but I'm going to have to disagree with you on the sense that even if you're not into 80s music, even if you're not into rock music or indie music or kind of this weird pop, I don't even want to call it pop, I feel like that's cheapening this movie. But even if you're not into that kind of music, just the way that this concert is presented, I would say that you would get something out of it. I think that this is a movie that is the perfect blend of what your standard concert film, rockumentary type, and kind of just this visual wildness. This is an imaginative movie. I think that's something that really impresses me about this movie. It is so visually amazing. There are so many things that are happening in this concert that will make you go, wow, what the hell is going on here? And it's, you know, that it's constantly, you know, just attacking your senses in a way that you don't normally get with a concert. Or I guess I should say that most concerts don't feel like they should have to do. Either they put too much into like the pyrotechnics or into choreography that just feels, you know, devoid of any meaning. This is a show that has meaning for lyrics that don't have a whole lot of meaning. It's like there's something odd and unusual and goofy and wild and imaginative. And I know I'm killing that word a lot here, but that's how I feel about what the Talking Heads represent as a band and what this film does for Talking Heads. If you're not a fan of Talking Heads, this could get you to be a fan of them. And if you are a fan of Talking Heads, why the hell have you not seen this movie? This is, in my opinion, an essential concert film to see, both for music enthusiasts and film enthusiast, because there's so many things that this documentary does that I think that students of films could really appreciate. So this is an unmitigated high pass. I cannot say enough good things about this documentary, and I'm probably going to come back to this movie more often. In fact, I might actually go out and buy the Blu-ray for this, because I want it on a surround sound system on the biggest screen I can. In fact, if it shows at like the Alamo Drafthouse or in a theatrical setting, I might actually go see it because I want to have that immersive experience. I think that this is a movie that you need it loud and you need it big. And yes, I strongly, strongly recommend this movie. I cannot recommend this movie stronger. But gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me on this wild ride. But I have to wonder, Kent, what do we have coming up next?
We're kind of looking at a different viewpoint of a movie we've already watched. It's kind of a behind the scenes of the making of a semi-fictionalized, or is it, behind the scenes of a completely awesome, amazing movie, and I can't say that with a straight face, of a movie we did for an April Fool's earlier. So let's just say the Oscar-nominated disaster artist. Oh, hi, Mark.
Actually, I cannot wait to talk about this movie. I have a lot of things I want to say about this. But if you're interested in anything that I've said or any of our any of my co-hosts have said about this episode or any other films that we've talked about, please feel free to hit us up on our Facebook page as well as on Twitter at Arthouse Legends. Or if you want to keep it to a gentle and relatively civil conversation, you can email us at arthouselegends@gmail.com and we will get back to you as soon as possible. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode, gentlemen. This is the Movie Dude, Eric.
This is Kent.
And this is Chris.
And Fiend.